Not long after Jeremy Denk's recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations came out on Nonesuch Records, it hit number one on Billboard's classical album chart. Mr. Denk is also known for his smart, funny writing on his blog, Think Denk, and for his contributions to The New Yorker, The New Republic, and NPR Music. And he was recently awarded one of this year's MacArthur Grants. He's currently on a national tour performing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 25 with the San Francisco Symphony and conductor Michael Tilson Thomas, which will bring him to Carnegie Hall on Wednesday, November 13th. That performance will be aired live on our sister station, WQXR, as part of the Carnegie Hall Live series. And I'm very pleased that all of that brings Jeremy Denk to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
In a post you wrote for NPR Music in March 2012 under the heading, Why I Hate the Goldberg Variations, you wrote that the best reason to hate them is because everybody loves them. But haven't they been a staple of your repertoire over the years?
They have ever since. Actually, a friend of mine who ran the Seattle Chamber Music Festival, Toby Sachs, she insisted I learn them for her festival one year, which is a piece that I always was desperate not to play, partly because it's so hard.
This is difficult to play?
Yes.
I thought Bach was just so easy. You just
toss it off, yeah. There's a famous quote of Bach to that effect of something like, just playing the right notes at the right time. There's nothing to it.
So you resisted, and then you started playing them, and obviously you fell in love.
I did, and I came up with this idea of playing Ligeti Etudes with the Goldberg Variations, and I loved the idea of tearing the world apart with Ligeti and then rebuilding it with Bach, and then that just became – I became the slave of that program, and here I am.
And the New York Times wrote that you have a profound affinity with Bach, called you one of our generation's most eloquent and thoughtful interpreters. Well, how do you interpret the Goldberg Variations anew, afresh, considering the fact that there have been so many great pianists who have recorded them?
Luckily, I made a little pact not to really listen to any other pianists' recordings for a while so that I could clear my head of them. Of course, I grew up with the Glenn Gould, especially the early one, but a little bit the later one.
But many people consider them eccentric enough so that you don't have to worry about being totally influenced.
Yeah, except he's such a big personality that it's inevitable. I mean, there's no question I can't really think of Bach without thinking of him anymore, and I'm a little bit angry about that, but I'm also, you know, he's obviously a great genius. So, I just approach it in the sort of, I mean, I think of Bach as this kind of really generous spirit encompassing all of humanity's possibilities in a more perfect way than most humans are able to. So for me, this piece has an incredible geniality and charm and an invention, and then these kind of moments of tremendous pathos. So I just tried to do that.
Are they more open to interpretation than other pieces that you might choose to play?
You know, I have this theory about composers and performers have this long-term codependent relationship in which the composer keeps telling more instructions to the performer over the centuries, from Bach to the present day. The scores get more and more marked up as if this kind of the composers have become more and more control freaky over time, and the performers are more and more subjugated. Bach has very few tempo. There are very few tempo markings in the Goldbergs. There's very few articulation markings. There's no dynamic markings. You know, there's nothing to tell you so many things about it, and that's, of course, when we hear a recording, we get married to one way of playing it, but there's so many.
Perhaps because Bach himself was such a great keyboard player, he probably knew what he wanted and didn't think that he had to tell anybody else.
Yeah, I think there is some element of that, and there's also, you know, Bach has the sort of confidence to show you this stream of notes, and he says, you figure it out.
Well, he also wrote them for the harpsichord, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
So what adjustments have to be made when you play them on the piano?
A lot of adjustments, because it was written for a two-manual, two keyboards, and a lot of the premise of the piece is these sort of hands crossing on the two keyboards. So there's lots of moments where the hands crash into each other on one keyboard, and then actually they come around and they come back towards each other as if like revisiting the site of an accident. This is a real treacherous part of the piece, and you have to make workarounds and solutions.
But obviously they've appealed to a lot of people. They've been reworked and arranged for everything from two guitars to jazz trio.
Yeah, Bach is incredibly translatable and transcribable. And actually, I think of the Goldbergs as kind of one of the biggest jazz riffs of all time written down, since it's just a working out of a harmony chart, basically.
Well, Bach really does swing, doesn't he?
He does swing.
I mean, I find myself tapping my foot sometimes if the thing is just moving right along.
Yeah, no, he has this wonderful rhythmic energy and bounciness and vitality.
What are you going to play for us?
Well, I have picked sort of two of the variations. They're sort of nemeses of each other. One is the first, number 13 is the first kind of expansive melody that we get of the, a lot of the variations are like little machines and they kind of work on one motive or another, like chewing them up. But this one, suddenly the landscape opens and you get this sort of blissful aria.
Jeremy Denk playing one of the Bach-Goldberg variations. Who was Goldberg?
Goldberg was the Count Dedicati, who apparently had an incredibly... Oh, I always mix up the details of this, but he had an incredibly gifted harpsichordist. It may have been the Count was Goldberg or the harpsichordist was Goldberg anyway. But there's some doubt about this story anyway, that everything's sort of... Apparently it was the Count couldn't get to sleep and he wanted this piece to settle him.
But Bach wrote it on commission.
It's
my sense that Bach in some ways is like Shakespeare in that everything that followed was different because they had written what they wrote.
Of course, yeah. I mean, and when you look at the next generation of really great composers, Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, each of them turned to Bach, especially Beethoven and Mozart in their later years. Suddenly, after this, all their successful years of composing, they turned to him as the source again of things.
You say in the DVD notes that accompany your CD, you have DVD notes. This is what's happening more and more. We're getting video discs along with recordings these days. You say that one of the most important elements is Bach's incredible sense of humor and sense of play.
Yes, It's a thing that I have, a little bee in my bonnet, I guess, about a lot of classical music in general. But one of the great elements of the Goldbergs is, as I said, there's two keyboards, and Bach is sort of obsessed with this hand-crossing games and kind of sort of childish crossings of, and one hand chasing another all the time happens. Imitations back and forth, and he keeps going between almost slapstick humor and the most deep emotion.
And does it matter whether he's writing for piano or harpsichord or clavichord or organ? Does he pretty much do the same sorts of things?
He writes idiomatically for each instrument, but the music is so susceptible to translation. Chris Thiele just did a beautiful CD, I thought, of the violin sonatas on mandolin. It has a completely different effect and affect, but it really works.
In a story, or a piece anyway, you wrote for The New Yorker earlier this year called Every Good Boy Does Fine, you described the piano lesson journal that your piano teacher kept while you were a kid. What was in that journal?
Well, just descriptions, a list of what I played and whether I played it well, medium well, or just absolutely terribly. And there's also little stars he drew. He didn't like the little plastic or the paste-on stars that most neighborhood teachers use, so he drew these kind of – some of them are on crutches and some of them are complaining. And then sometimes there weren't even stars. They were like slugs or snails.
Did that lead you to keep notes on your own playing?
I don't have any notes on my own playing from those. This is the record that I have of all those years of study. It's interesting. It's very precious to me, obviously.
Will you play another piece for us?
Sure. And this is, as I was saying, kind of the nemesis of the other one. And towards the end of the piece, this is the last minor key variation. And it opens up in a completely different way, like kind of exploring the chromatic and dark and miserable spaces, the really tragic parts of the...
Well, can we understand Bach's thinking when we think of the sequence of the different variations?
Yeah, no, it's a big story.
Are they talking to each other? Is there a dialogue involved?
Oh, yes. I mean, the sequence is partly just a sequence of contrast, but then he scatters these sort of three minor key variations in a very key moments in the whole drama. And this one is actually the last one and the kind of climactic one. And after this sort of impasse, the piece kind of releases itself into a joyous ending. At least that's how I hear it and feel it.
Jeremy Denk, we're talking about Bach's Goldberg Variations. His recording of it for Nonesuch immediately rose up the charts. I don't know if that matters because some awful things rise up the pop charts, but in classical music, people really know what they're buying and made number one after just 3 weeks after it hit the charts.
Thank you.
Jeremy Denk is our guest. That piece is so powerful, sets such a strong mood. I almost thought it would sound like something from a later period, like a romantic piece.
Yeah, the harmonies explore the boundaries of what's possible. They're the most. It's the most stretched and extenuated journey that Bach takes us on in the whole piece.
You're performing Mozart's Concerto No. 25 at Carnegie Hall with the San Francisco Symphony on the 13th of this coming month, under the direction of Michael Tilson Thomas. Is that the only piece you'll be performing that
Yeah,
night?
Just the Mozart. It's a big piece, though.
Uh-huh. So what else will be on the program, do you know?
Leonora No. 3, Beethoven, and Steve Mackey's piece, Eating Greens. It's a wonderful wonderful title. And then they're doing the Copland Symphonic Ode at the end.
Does it take a major adjustment to switch from playing Bach to Mozart to Ligeti?
Yes, it does. And I keep going back and forth, so I get this kind of sense of schizophrenia and slightly stretching myself. But Mozart has a slightly different persona and an almost more actor-like presence. You have to inhabit the music and change from one opera character to another.
Jeremy Dent, as I said, will be performing Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 25 with the San Francisco Symphony with Michael Tilson Thomas on Wednesday, November 13th. For ticket information, you can go to our website at wnyc.org. You can also hear that concert on our sister station, WQXR, as part of the Carnegie Hall Live series. Jeremy, thank you so much for being on our show. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much.